It is Thursday, October 20th, 2022. My name is Emma Bigland, in for Sam Seether, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Nicholas Kardaris, addiction expert and author of Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis, and How to Restore Our Sanity. And later in the program, Eugene Puryear, host of Breakthrough News, will be with us to discuss U.S. involvement in Haiti's current governmental and social crisis. Meanwhile, Liz Truss is stepping down as Britain's prime minister just 44 days into her job after fierce blowback to her corporate tax plan, which sent her cabinet into a tailspin. I wish we kind of had those reactions here in the United States to that kind of stuff. And what do you know, Boris Johnson is reportedly throwing his hat back into the ring just when you thought he was gone. Early voting in Georgia has reportedly exceeded 2020 presidential election levels on its second day after exceeding 2018 levels on day one. That can't be bad news. In Ohio, Tim Ryan is going public with his frustration over national Democratic groups not helping him out more with spending. The Senate Majority PAC has given him $0, which is confounding to me. I mean, with the closeness of this race, I don't blame him. Bernie Sanders is hitting the road to turn out the young vote and folk. In these midterms, Oregon, Nevada, Michigan, Wisconsin, and more. Check him out if he's coming to your town.
He's going to Texas too.
Yeah, Texas, right.
Love it here. Give me some cowboy boots.
The extremist Fifth Circuit Appeals Court has ruled that the CFPB's independent funding mechanism that comes from the Fed is unconstitutional. Also, killing at least temporarily the agency's restrictions on short-term high-interest loans. So a win for predatory payday lenders. Woo! The Social Security Administration has announced that people can now select the sex that aligns with their gender identity on records for that social program. U.S. mortgage rates have hit a two-decade high, the direct result of the Fed's own hikes. A sharp downturn in the housing market is likely to continue. Glad Biden was Mr. Bipartisan and kept Trump's Fed chair on. Although I don't know how much better Yellen would be. It's just the Fed. They're a one-trick pony. Speaking of Trump, he appeared for a deposition yesterday in a defamation lawsuit brought by E. Jean Carroll, who accused Trump of rape. And despite unanimously voting to subpoena him last week, the January 6th committee hasn't been able to actually do so yet because they're still trying to find a Trump lawyer that says they're authorized to accept service of that subpoena. They're playing hide and seek. An American citizen was sentenced to 16 years in a Saudi prison over tweets. Just another thing for Biden to reevaluate in terms of our relationship with them. And lastly,
seems like we're breaking up.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like, no, it's not. It's an abusive relationship from one side where the victim keeps threatening to break up, but keeps going back for more. Sorry to be dark about it. And lastly, the African Union has scheduled peace talks for next week over the crisis in Tigray. Hundreds of thousands have estimated to have died, and millions have been displaced. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. Thanks for being with us on Thursday. Very excited for the show today. Hope I didn't miss much yesterday. Hope everyone wasn't here just crapping all over me, shit-talking per usual when I'm not in the room. That's kind of how I feel about you two.
That's what I wasn't being weird.
Yeah, I mean, not on mic.
Oh, well, that's good.
People on the voicemail, on the phones, maybe.
Well,
I might have heard something.
Everyone loves to talk about me. We have a few things to talk about today. Before we get to what's happening in the UK, I wanted to highlight this piece in The American Prospect, written by Ryan Cooper, who's been on the show a few times before. Because to me, it seems like a massive missed opportunity that the Democrats have not been running pretty much at all on Social Security and Medicare. And Ryan really laid the stakes of this out pretty clearly for what will happen if the Democrats actually do lose the House. Because despite the rebranding of the Republican Party as populist because just Trump decides to speak the way that he, off the cuff, as if that is a substitute for actual policies that benefit people, they are still the same Republican Party, if not more extreme, when it comes to fiscal policy and policy towards social programs. The stakes of losing the House are immense because, as Ryan Cooper writes here, and I'll just read from his piece, there's been a simmering debate over the past few years as to whether claims of conservative populism mean anything in a practical policy sense. Many have claimed that things have changed from the old days of tax cuts for the rich, business-friendly deregulation, and trickle-down economics, like Senator Josh Hawley once wrote, "We are a working-class party now. This is the future." We now have an answer to this question, and it is firmly negative. If they win in 2022, Republicans are promising the same old massive cuts to social programs, above all Social Security and Medicare, which they've been trying to get at for decades. And they're going to try to force President Biden to agree by threatening a global financial apocalypse. All four GOP representatives running to head the House Budget Committee have promised that they are going to take the debt ceiling hostage to get big cuts. "Our main focus has got to be on non-discretionary. It's got to be on entitlement," said Representative Buddy Carter of Georgia. Specifically, they mentioned increasing the eligibility age for Social Security and Medicare, which is amazing because it's so obvious that it should be lowered, not increased. And that's how we can get Medicare for All, by the way, is lowering it by five-year portions over a period of time until eventually, hopefully, everybody is covered. So this is obviously in the wrong direction. And adding means tests or work requirements. Representative Kevin McCarthy, who will probably, I'm thinking of football, ESPN later.
Got Cowboys on the brain.
Who will probably be Speaker of the House if Republicans take control, endorse this strategy. You can't just continue down the path to keep spending and adding to the debt. As we've discussed, these programs are self-funding. You pay into it your whole life. You get it on the other end. It's very simple. If they are able to be kept intact if the Republicans chose to do so, but they pretend that's not the case. And the thing about why this is more dangerous than, say, even if Trump was president, frankly, for this to actually happen is because holding the debt ceiling hostage while there's a Democrat in office is one of the Republicans' favorite tactics as a way to get what they want in cuts to programs like Social Security and Medicare, because they're afraid to take it head on. They want it to happen through debt ceiling negotiations as a way to obscure what they're actually trying to do. And when, say, the global economy collapses and the government gets shut down, they can't raise the debt ceiling, then the which is, by the way, a completely arbitrary mechanism that doesn't need to exist, but this government's stupid, so putting that aside for now. Then they can blame Biden. Oh, he's not being bipartisan. He's shutting down the government. And the blame for this kind of stuff usually falls on the party that's in power. There were some exceptions in the Obama administration because it was so clear what the Republicans were doing. But using the threat of economic collapse and turmoil and holding that hostage as a way to get the cuts that they want would be something that they could feasibly do with Biden, because they don't want to put this front and center if, say, there's a Republican president, God forbid, in 24, and they control both houses. Then they're going to be scared to do it because it's the third rail of politics. People don't want these programs being taken away. But if you can do it through budgetary negotiations, if you can do it with a Democrat at the head of the executive branch, then that looks better for Republicans. So that's what they're definitely going to do if they take back the House. And I wish Democrats had been running on this for a little bit more. We had that soundbite of Chuck Grassley saying it was a dumb idea, but that it was clear that members of his party were considering it and wanted to do such a thing. And yeah, frankly, it's concerning. But those are the stakes for what we're dealing with right now. With that said, let's have a little bit of fun because, I mean, the Tories are in shambles right now. Now that Liz Truss's administration has fallen into disarray, she's only been in power for 6 weeks, or been appointed prime minister 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, like 40 days or like I think something like 4.1 Scaramucci's.
That is always the scale we should measure these things by. And I mean, what's fascinating here is that a general election is going to be held next year. The Tories have dismal polling numbers as of right now. There's Labour's, according to some polls, up by somewhere near 30 points in comparison. Now, there's still a ways away, and when people actually have to vote, and based on the quality of like what actually Labour's advocating for, things could definitely change. But I think voters seem to be feeling the turmoil of leadership right now, and it's affecting their opinions of the party, naturally, especially given the fact that what Truss was trying to do immediately when she came into power was slash corporate taxes. And there was immediate blowback for that, so much so that she had multiple cabinet members who had to resign, and like just the tax cuts were beginning to be, or the plan was beginning to go into motion. They had to immediately reverse course because it was the markets responded in a negative way, but also because it was so wildly unpopular.
Yeah, she fired her financial minister Kwasi Kwarteng like literally days after he implemented her policies, and the guy, like you said, that replaced him just rolled back every single thing he did. That was his first move in office, was to erase his legacy.
Yeah.
Or when Trump's like, we're gonna be tired of winning, like that's basically where like the neoliberal right is. Like they're like, well we took power, like tax cuts, right? Like we can just keep doing this. And actually there's a certain point where even like commerce itself is like, we need to have some sort of like,
right,
you know,
stabilizing force at
yeah,
least. So I mean, it was one of those instances. It was very much like Trump, where that, no, this is too destabilizing, where it wasn't, you know, just lefties that were spearheading opposition to this. It was basically everyone, because the pound,
like global financial system.
Yeah, the pound plummeted. And here's some of the reactions to it. We have two videos for you here. This is an ITV News presenter kind of giving a summation of what's happened.
It has been a night of astonishing scenes at Westminster, with reports of jostling, manhandling, bullying and shouting outside the parliamentary lobbies in a supposed vote of confidence in the government. The Deputy Chief Whip was reported to have left the scene saying, "I'm absolutely effing furious. I just don't effing care anymore," before he resigned, along with the Chief Whip. But we've just been told they have now officially unresigned. The Home Secretary has, however, definitely gone. In short, it is total, absolute, abject chaos.
And then this was this, so German TV, there's no translation here, guys, and you don't need it, because just wait until the end. This was German TV's kind of explanation of what is going on at 10 Downing.
Woraufhin dann der stellvertretende Fraktionschef das Parlament mit den Worten verließ, I'm fucking furious and I don't fucking care anymore. Ich übersetze das jetzt mal nicht, aber das ist eine Partei, wo wirklich
So you got that, guys? I should have done a little bit of a not safe for work warning there, but hey. You know, you'll deal
with
that.
Tell
me
learning German.
Right. It's just a German phrase. But I mean, who wants to captain the Titanic now? Anybody?
Boris, baby's back.
Boris apparently is like, but bring me back in.
It's,
but
it's
like
the restoration of Boris, it's happening.
Exactly. They didn't know how good it was till I was gone. But either way, it seems like at the very least, whoever fills Truss's position, there's going to be turmoil regardless, given the lack of public support for any piece of the agenda and inflation and what the fallout has been from the Russian war in Ukraine in terms of energy prices and things like that. There's a lot of discontent right now, and I'm interested to see what the platform is for Labor going into next year's general.
I mean, yeah, what, like a slight raise in tuition prices and some cuts to the NHS?
Wow.
Like, I don't know. Like, it won't be that bad, obviously, but it is a real shame that, like, you look at these models that show, like, the generic party ballot, and Labor is just seemingly on pace for whenever the election's called, a massive, massive landslide, and it's going to be Keir Starmer, and what's he going to do?
Right.
I mean, it'd be nice if Corbyn was still in there. I'll just say that.
In these kinds of circumstances,
oh,
we would be dancing in the streets, most likely. But that's not the case. However, at the very least today, we can rejoice in the downfall of Liz Truss and the entire clusterfuck. That's two F-bombs within the first half hour of the program for you.
I have to confess, I used to follow UK politics pretty closely. I even did some fact-checking over there like 10 years ago. I didn't do one single long read of Liz Truss in her entire time. I don't really know.
I mean, that is now you've been vindicated exactly. Because that would have been a waste of your damn time. She was a flash in the pan, and now she's gone. She'll be out of there in a few days. Just some fun news to start off your day. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Dr. Nicholas Kardaris, a psychologist and author of Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis, and How to Restore Our Sanity. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined by Dr. Nicholas Kardaris, psychologist, addiction expert, and author of Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity. Nicholas, thanks so much for coming, or Nick, however you prefer to be called.
Nicholas is fine. Thank you, Emma, for having me on the show.
Of course. So you begin your book talking a bit about the impact of COVID and our relationships with technology and social media, and one of the things that struck me was how remote, you know, school was this kind of melding of an experience that was mostly when I was a kid, at least, a bit of a break from when I'd, you know, want to play Sims on my computer for 5 hours straight. It was an opportunity to be away from screens and to have that learning happen in social spaces. And it made sense that learning had to be remote, but it did accelerate a certain relationship between education and technology. What was your observations as a psychologist and as somebody who's been studying this about that dynamic in particular?
Yeah, well, to be clear, before COVID, we had a nuclear bomb on our mental health that was happening over the last 10 to 15 years. We had increasingly spiking rates of depression and suicidality and overdoses and anxiety disorders. So, you know, the narrative has been that, you know, one step forward for technology, two step backwards for humanity. So our mental health metrics were getting progressively worse up until 2019, and then COVID was kerosene to that fire. It had already gotten really pretty bad. We had the worst suicide, overdose, depression rates, as I just mentioned. And so COVID was sort of a beta test that really amplified all those dynamics, made it double screen time and triple depression. And you just saw the disaster that happened with not just kids, but, you know, the rest of us as the adults in the room were also severely impacted by being alone, isolated, and screen staring.
So how do you, and those metrics went up a lot, like just basically with COVID, like how do you distinguish between, say, the isolation element contributing to the mental health crisis and the actual technological element?
Yeah, so like overdoses went from 70,000 to over 100,000, and suicide rates, the numbers aren't all in yet, but they also significantly spiked. And we know that isolation is sort of the cousin of, depression and slash, you know, the precursor for a lot of self-harm types of behavior like suicide and other types of self-harm. So interestingly, you know, what we see when we look at the mental health metrics generationally, the more plugged in the generation, the higher the reported rates of loneliness and suicidality. So when you go from boomer, Gen Xer, millennial, Gen Zer, you see that each increasingly youthful generation is getting more and more isolated and alone. And that goes against the narrative that we were all sold, right? We were all told that social media was going to be this amazing connector, and that was going to be a good thing for us as a social species to have social media. And what we've seen is, for example, the numbers are 1 in 4 millennials have zero friends, none. And that's a pretty high number that isn't reflected in Gen Xers or baby boomers. So this level of loneliness and isolation amongst the most plugged-in people is a really pretty important indicator and a sad indicator that the more plugged-in you are, the lonelier you are.
Well, that is it pairs nicely. It's not nice. It's very sad. But with some of the internal Facebook documents that came out that you cite in your book as well. Can you talk a little bit about how much these social media companies understand that what they're doing is contributing to exactly the dynamic you describe, and particularly with kids?
Yeah, it would be bad enough if a company was selling us a product that they didn't know, you know, kind of unintentionally harming us, you know, oops, you know, we're marketing you some toy or some device, and next thing you know, it's, you know, we didn't know. But what the Frances Haugen, she was the Facebook whistleblower and that employee of Facebook that showed us the internal emails, there were two things that happened. They had internal research at Instagram that showed that vulnerable teens that were on Instagram, British teens had 12% higher rates of suicidality, American teens had 6% rates of suicidality, and that if you had an eating disorder, your self-harm rates went up 17%. And they knew this, and there were internal emails that they were having discussions, should we adjust the algorithms to make them less toxic? Because here's the thing. It's not as if sad or depressed people go on Instagram and they get sadder. They're targeted. So the algorithm acts like a heat-seeking missile towards people's psychological vulnerabilities and attacks them with information that will make them more unwell, because being more unwell, they're more inclined to rubberneck toxic content. So the young girl struggling with body image issues is more prone to look at toxic content that it's going to be hurtful for them. And knowing this, they did this anyway. That's where I think it's really, there's legal liability there, but there's also ethical liability there as well.
Are there any other conditions that you think that you would point to outside of the social media products in and of themselves that would be contributing to kind of a compounding effect that you're seeing with rates of depression, suicide, et cetera, in concert with social media usage?
Yeah, a lot of depression and self-harm behavior is a byproduct of disconnectedness, people feeling disconnected or alienated. So if you're feeling disconnected from a sense of meaning or purpose in your life, right? If you're feeling a sense of, you don't have opportunity, economic opportunities. So, you know, we know that people that are feeling hopeless are more likely to hurt themselves. But we're seeing a huge suicide epidemic in China that not quite dwarfs ours, but is outpacing our suicide epidemic, because they've gone through a seismic shift in their culture where they've gone from an agrarian society to a post-industrial dehumanizing factory working society. And so they're committing suicides at much higher rates because they're despondent and depressed and there's no economic upward mobility. So people that feel desperate and despondent, that's why you saw, when you look at the epidemiological charts for the overdose epidemic, it follows the Rust Belt, right? So Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, these are the states that have the most economic challenges, right? So people who live in those communities are more likely to hurt themselves. The other thing that I point as a contributing factor is we're compromising young people's psychological immune system, which is a phrase that I like to use. And we're compromising it by things like the stereotypical helicopter parenting and things that are sort of taking away opportunities for our kids or young people to develop a sense of resilience. So when you're essentially doing things for young people, not allowing them to work through certain issues, you're robbing them of opportunities to grow more, to strengthen and be stronger psychologically. So those are intervening variables, as well as to the toxicity of not just the content of social media, but we weren't meant to be sedentary and screen staring. So we've turned into a sedentary and screen staring culture when we know that the most healthy cultures on the planet are pre-industrial and indigenous cultures that have much more physical activity built into their societies and much more face-to-face community. Those are the two other factors that are really greatly contributing to this whole psychiatric disaster that's happening.
I mean, part of this just seems to me like capitalism, right? Well, social media is a leg of it, but it's also the same people experiencing the dynamics that you describe also bear the brunt of like a standard of living decrease, cost of living increases, housing insecurity, mm-hmm. insane healthcare costs, at least here domestically. And then, I mean, you spoke a bit about differences in what's happening in China, like that is, I feel, I just something I'd like to note, you know.
Sure. Well, absolutely. All those are contributing factors to the CDC has called them deaths of despair. Deaths of despair are suicide, overdose, and chronic alcoholism, which had spiked to over 200,000 in 2019, and have, as I said earlier, have all gone up. So a person that feels everything that you just mentioned and then some. And so, of course, those people are going to escape through digital escapism. And then we find out that if you're on social media or just any kind of screen time, for the more hours a day that you're on, the higher the likelihood you are to be clinically depressed. So, you know, these all go kind of hand in hand. I'm depressed in my life. I feel despondent. I'm going to escape in my screen. And the more I escape in my screen, round and round it goes, the more depressed I continue to get.
So can you talk a bit about the different social media platforms and the ways that they target people specifically? Is it really all one and the same in the degree of severity and in the kinds of algorithms that they use, from TikTok to Facebook to YouTube or into Instagram? Or are there some that are much worse, or there are some that have any kind of like ethical guardrails imposed upon them? What would you say is the worst and the offender of all of these?
I think they use the same playbook. I think the difference is some are more popular amongst certain populations. So Instagram tends to be the most impactful because it tends to be the most used, but they all use the same algorithm-fueled playbook. You know, I've really come to see, Emma, social media, I've come to understand it now. It's almost like a living organism, right? And what feeds social media but our most vitriolic, emotional, reactive content? And what's the coin of the realm on social media, but it's the most over-the-top actors? So everything from toxic influencers who, I mean, there's a subset of influencers on social media who we're not talking the Kylie Jenner toxic values, materialism, toxicity. That's one thing. But now we're talking about people that have psychiatric disorders that are getting billions of views and whose followers are now beginning to emulate or mimic in the social contagion and some of their psychiatric unwellness. Because again, what's popular on social media is this over the top type of behavior. And so rare is the popular social media influencer that is a thoughtful person discussing a topic. So we feed social media our most vitriolic responses. Social media then regurgitates it back to us in this echo chamber feedback loop. And then round and round that goes, we feed the beast, and the beast feeds us back increasingly toxic content. And so it's not healthy, because eventually that echo chamber just inflates everything from political polarization to psychiatric unwellness. So this goes beyond just I'm depressed because I don't have a life and I'm in front of my computer too much. This goes into like shaping influences and behavior modification and things that are much more complex and insidious.
And so I just had a question that totally, totally flew out of my mind. I guess the one question I'd like to ask is just the concept of combating this from a governmental level. I know that you say in your book that antitrust is not enough to solve the problem. We've talked about antitrust on this show before, but we're a political show, so we focus a lot on, you know, what the government can do to combat mm-hmm. this. But antitrust and regulating some of these algorithms seems to be the way that I would go if I were queen of America, but is that enough? What ways would that actually be able to be implemented in a way that, say, like limits exposure for children, for example? Are there possible solutions found in those two options that I lay out?
I think antitrust is definitely a part of the equation. I do think, and Lina Khan is looking. You know, she's one of the foremost experts on antitrust legislation. These are absolutely monopolies and need to go the way of Ma Bell and into Baby Bells. And they need to be broken down because they're too monolithic, powerful right now. They're too big to fail, but they're also too big and too destructive. So antitrust, you know, the repeal of Section 230, where they're immune from liability, this notion that they're not publishers, you know, this, you know, big tech will wave their hands up and say, well, we're just sort of a message board and people post whatever they want to. We're not responsible for our content. When in fact, we know they are the gatekeepers. They're the biggest gatekeepers of information ever in our recorded history. So, you know, this idea that every two or three years we drag Zuckerberg and friends in front of the Senate, they say a version of, oops, we're sorry, we'll do better. And then nothing happens, because they do have the second strongest lobbying efforts, you know, after the big pharma. Big tech is right there. So we need to attack them. And I'm aware of certain initiatives from attorney generals and certain legislation that is trying to create an online safety act. Senator Blumenthal in Connecticut has co-sponsored a bill for the Online Safety Act that would really help at least minimize some of the toxic damage. At the very least, they need their own version of the FCC. They need an oversight committee that's going to help to at least regulate. I'm not a censorship person. I don't think we need. I'm a little bit, because I'm an old school libertarian, I'm concerned of censorship, because I do think that people should be able to discern information for themselves. But there does need to be a regulatory body to make sure that everybody's playing nicely in the sandbox and according to certain guidelines, which there currently isn't. Right now, it's totally the Wild West and self-regulated. And that's a problem.
It's interesting you bring up Section 230, because that is such a point of contention. And us on the left, there's been a bit of a split in what people think about repealing it, since most of that comes from, like, the first we were really hearing about it was in the Trump years, where he was really banging the table for it. But can you just expand on what that would do in terms of the liability for these corporations, and how potentially it could further what we describe?
Yeah, so I was an expert witness for a capital murder case in Palm Beach County, Florida, where a teenage kid, a suburban Palm Beach County kid, had become radicalized online through YouTube. He watched YouTube 14, 16 hours a day, went from being a progressive liberal to eventually fell down a rabbit hole of ISIS indoctrination videos. Was shown decapitation videos. I won't get into the explicit details, but committed one of the most horrific murders you could ever imagine. And the defense that I participated in was an insanity defense that he was essentially brainwashed and radicalized through YouTube. Now YouTube can't be sued under Section 230 because they're not responsible for their content. Now, to be fair, they do try to remove, because he had seen over 1,000 decapitation videos on YouTube by the time he committed this murder. Now, YouTube does try to remove certain toxic content, but then they usually get reposted pretty quickly under different IP addresses. But there is a responsibility there for the platform and what they allow to be on their platform. And Section 230 doesn't allow for litigation when a harm is done by that platform. Because again, big tech will say, we're just the message board. We're not responsible for who puts the message up. And I don't think that's accurate, because they are now the biggest disseminators of information, of news content, of everything imaginable. So how can they not bear the same responsibility as any news organization or any publisher for that matter?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is the rub there, where they're trying to portray themselves as social connectiveness. And as you described, there's no connection, but they are publishers, and we are in a new era where they need to be treated as such. And that is, I think, their kind of like veneer of branding themselves as social connection engines versus what you describe is, I feel like, very quickly eroding, because people are starting to see what the reality is.
It's kind of like the Frankenstein monster, right? Dr. Frankenstein wanted to create life, but then things went sideways. And so things have gone sideways. We have to keep in mind, these are the five most powerful, the big tech oligarchs, you know, Bezos, Zuckerberg, Gates, these are the five most powerful people that have ever lived, because they don't just control a commodity. Like J.D. Rockefeller controlled Standard Oil and 90% of the oil in the United States. They control everything. They control information, what we see, when we see it, how we process it. So they are the gatekeepers. So not only are they the wealthiest people that have ever lived, but they control us. You know, so they can shape how we vote, how we think, all of it. And so they need some level of oversight, and it's already gone too far. You know, we're a little 5 or 6 years kind of late to the dance in terms of saying these folks have gone way too much power. And I think part of it, I write about this in Digital Madness, I think we were lulled, because I call it a form of Stockholm syndrome, right? We're all in love with our tech. Everyone loves their devices. And so even though we've been monetized, manipulated, I would say addicted or enslaved in some cases, we've fallen in love with our captors, right? We're like Patty Hearst in the Symbionese Liberation Army. We've been kidnapped by our love affair with technology, and yet we've deified and idolized some of our big tech icons. They're like pop culture heroes.
Ew.
And so that's
no,
part
not
of the
for
problem.
Us. Not for us on this show, but
well,
like
not to, for you.
Right. But the thing is, exactly. Like, we should be pushing back on that. And just lastly here, what's also unique about their product and the profits that they create for themselves is that we are both the consumers, and we are also, in the case of content creators, we are creating the product in and of itself. So we're consuming and creating it. And without that, they have also like no actual physical product. And so it's a whole different dynamic, and the rules of old don't apply, even though I feel like still people are trying to apply them.
Right, but they incentivize content creation that's the most sort of, again, eyeball grabbing, which isn't necessarily always the best or the most truthful or the most healthy. So they incentivize, let's call it toxic content creation, because that gets the eyeballs, and then that begins to shape the society, right? I do think part of our political divide, at least the extreme end of it, because it's called an extremification loop. Social media, by nature of its algorithm amplification effect, polarizes. And my hypothesis is, if you're a kid or a teenager raised in that polarization sorting mechanism, you can only now process information that's in those priority buckets, left or right. And what I'm seeing in young people that I treat in my clinics, they are not able to see nuance. So the gray area, or the nuance, or critical thinking has totally evaporated. And I'm seeing this as a direct result of people who only live in these extremity loops. And they don't say, oh, well, wait a second, we can have there's a gray area here in any topic, whether it's political, scientific, what have you. So now, and it becomes emotional reactivity rather than critical thinking and debate and reasoned. That's also one of the big things that I think is underappreciated.
Gotcha. Well, I really appreciate your time today. Dr. Nicholas Cardaris, psychologist, addiction expert, author of Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis and How to Restore Our Sanity. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Emma. I appreciate it.
Of course. We are going to take a quick break, though, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Eugene Puryear, host of Breakthrough News and author of Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America, to talk about what's happening in Haiti and U.S. and international involvement. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined now by Eugene Puryear, host of Breakthrough News and author of Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. Eugene, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, Emma, thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
Well, I'm excited to pick your brain on what's happening in Haiti right now. We've covered it a bit on the show, but right now, there's been a scary escalation because it seems that the United States and Mexico has basically proposed a multinational force to intervene in Haiti. And if you know anything about the history of intervention in Haiti, it is a very dark history. And so before we get to what's happening in the news today, could you give us a bit of a rundown of what's happened since the assassination of Moïse and the conditions that he left the Haitian government in, which has created this instability?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a crucial question. So last year, the former president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated. And what's also notable about that is even prior to his assassination, he'd actually been ruling for a year by decree. He had dissolved the parliament. He had dissolved the judiciary. So you already had a very unstable situation. There are these huge protests. We were there in March of 2021, of course, before he was assassinated, these massive protests, hundreds of thousands of people all across the country, everywhere you could imagine. So it was already a very tense situation, fragile situation. The state itself was really starting to come apart. You know, the police force, for instance, you know, was breaking off and people were forming, you know, gangs of cops. And there were all these different elements that were already making everything feel very unstable in Haiti, that something had to change, that it was really on the brink. So then you have Jovenel, who's assassinated. And one thing that's notable is the current so-called prime minister, Ariel Henry, who was essentially appointed basically by the United States. He got two calls from the assassins that night. So we don't know exactly his involvement. He claims it was nothing. But after that information came out, he shut down the investigation. But ultimately, Henry comes into power and is somehow even more illegitimate. He is basically, there's 10 senators who just voted him in as the head of the country. And they're really at the behest of the United States. He was able to assume power. And he has been attempting since then to try to find some way to gain a level of legitimacy for his rule, which he has failed to do. The protests that have been happening have actually been intensifying over the past month or so. And the vast majority of Haitian people want to see him out because they see Henri as essentially indicative of the broader reality of Haiti since you know, really 2020, but I think many people see it going back much further, certainly since 2018, of that the Haitian government's really post-earthquake 2010, if you will, have been, or really since the election in 2016 of Martelly, been deeply unrepresentative, not representative of the Haitian people, and continuing these policies that are really neo-colonial, neoliberal policies that keep the Haitian people in poverty. So Henri is basically trying to hold a lid on a boiling pot of what Haiti has become, which is people wanting to see significant change. But the situation there has deteriorated significantly. You have about 4.7 million people. It's about 42% of the country are facing acute hunger. About 1.8 million are in emergency hunger situations. There is an absolutely skyrocketing cost of living crisis in Haiti, like everywhere else. But a way to think about it is the price per gallon of gas, of petrol, is about $4 at this point after it went up. But the average salary for, you know, about 68% of Haitians is only $2 a day. So the basic prices of everything are far beyond what most people are really able to afford. So there's an intense social crisis that's taking place. And then the deterioration of the state capacity has also led to this huge rise in instability. Kidnappings are up about 58% on last year, where thousands of people were kidnapped. And it was, you know, probably the worst year ever in Haiti for that. So there's a major continuation of that happening. There are checkpoints that are happening all over the place, which leads to extortion. There are sort of fuel mafias and mafias emerging around a lot of basic goods that people need, and hoarding them and then raising the prices even higher than, you know, what you read in the newspaper and what you see on the street in the various stores and the various shops. So it's an extremely dire, extremely acute social situation that's really being exacerbated by the fact that there is no entity that can actually govern Haiti with any legitimacy over the past couple years.
So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about the history of U.S. involvement, particularly with the in the halls of power in Haiti? Because, I mean, we've talked about it, you know, historically, what was 1915, right? Was it the invasion and then occupation of Haiti? But that it's kind of been a bit of a playground for U.S. like NGOs and secret and covert involvement, but also not so covert for a long period of time. And I mean, this guy Henri is clearly a puppet of the United States, but that's nothing new within Haiti.
No, I think that's a great point. And in fact, Henri is sort of a retread. In 2004, the United States sponsored a coup against the then president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who really is the only sort of popular leader who's ever been legitimately elected in Haiti, you know, really since the Cold War started, quite frankly. And Henri played a major role in something called the Group of 200 that was, you know, essentially the group that came together to try to legitimize this U.S. coup. And, you know, to give people a sense of the coup, the U.S. Marines basically just rolled up on Aristide's house, kidnapped him and flew him to Africa. So it was like a straight up coup. But Henri comes out of that reality. And it just speaks to how very close the relationship is, as you point out, between the U.S. and the Haitian elites. I mean, certainly, as I pointed out, and as the New York Times reported at the time, the only way Henri even came into power is the guy who is basically the second in command of Jovenel after he's assassinated. The U.S. just called him up and said, you have to let Henri be the prime minister. And of course, he could not resist. You know, in 1996, Strobe Talbot, who is the Deputy Secretary of State of the Clinton administration, he actually spoke to this very issue when the U.S. So Clinton in 94, he sends in about 20,000 U.S. troops. We'll get to that. But point being, the troops are about to leave. So Strobe Talbot said, and Peter Howard has laid this out in his book, you know, even after our troops leave, we will maintain control because of our relationships of USAID and the private business community. And so when you look at the use of humanitarian aid and economic assistance, certainly for a long time, but let's say from the mid-1980s on, what you can see is that the United States has done everything possible to avoid creating state capacity in Haiti. So almost all of the economic aid and economic assistance from the U.S., the main trade partner, main aid giver to Haiti, goes to these private NGOs. It's become known as the Republic of NGOs. NGOs or to private businesses. So the government basically is unable to do anything without these private businesses and these private NGOs that are accountable, quote unquote, to the U.S., not to the Haitian government. But that means that the ultimate veto on how anything is able to work is basically residing inside of the United States. And to a lesser extent, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, the so-called core group countries, which include Canada, France, and also the United Nations and the OAS. So there's this sort of constellation of international powers really led by the United States and seconded up by Canada that do everything possible to make sure, like, for just to give people an example, only 1% of the U.S. aid that went to Haiti after the earthquake in 2010 went to the government. Yeah. Overall, only about 3% of aid from around the world went to the Haitian national budget. So they use the economic aid, they use the debt relief, all these different things as a politically coercive mechanism to control Haitian governments by making sure they have control of all the money through these NGOs and their dense relationships with these various private networks. So, you know, you can go all the way back to the coup of 91 of Aristide. So he's been the president twice, was cooed twice. You know, the head of his anti-drug organization said that the CIA deputy head of mission in 91 told him, you know, oh, what we really want you guys to do is fight back against this coup. He ended up not doing it because it turns out it was actually a trap that was designed to create legitimacy for the coup by the CIA by saying, oh, we're going against these radical, like, pro-Cuban armed groups, and it's actually democratic. But thankfully, that didn't happen, and they were unable to do it. But it just speaks to how deeply involved at every single level, the business level, the NGO level, and the political level, the U.S. really is in Haiti.
Yeah. I mean, so what, like, the rest of the 90% goes to the Clinton Foundation or whatever garbage. I mean, literally, though, that was one of the in my political education, just like understanding how ridiculous the entire concept of like how NGOs operate internationally are and how it's really just a fig leaf for U.S. involvement. And then how since the 70s, the Clintons have been obsessed with Haiti. And it's like, why? Why is that the case? And you kind of see the ramifications of that, like, neoliberal politics on steroids and how aid is being funneled towards these NGOs that do actually nothing for the Haitian people. And let's, I guess, turn to Dan Foote, because he has become this real central player, at least in terms of us here domestically, helping us understand how messed up U.S. policy is towards Haiti. Dan Foote was the ambassador to Haiti. He resigned in protest last year because of the continued deportation of Haitian migrants who were seeking refuge in the United States, seeking asylum, sending them back to Haiti, and basically violating international and United States law when they should be able to go through a process. And of course, there were those horrible images of Border Patrol agents using their reins to assault Haitian migrants. I think he resigned shortly after that. But basically, he's contended that the Biden administration continues to support Henri because he's been okay with their migrant deportation policies. Is that a big part of the United States' relationship with him?
You know, I think Ambassador Foote is 100% correct about that. I think the United States obviously is deeply concerned about the political implications of immigration. And I think, you know, similar to the marriage of convenience the EU has with Erdogan or Morocco, the U.S. has a similar sort of relationship with Haiti, where their willingness, and I think the Haitian elites and Henri, they know this. It's essentially a chip. They're using Haitian migrants as a chip to gain their own support. So essentially, they know that they can get the U.S. support if they're willing to essentially turn the island into a prison and do whatever they can to keep people from leaving and accept anyone they send back. And it was notable, you know, because I was actually there in Haiti when Biden put out the famous "Don't Come" tweet. And it was obviously a huge topic of discussion in Haiti. And the thing that people kept coming back to is why the image that was embedded in the tweet was in English. Because obviously most people in Haiti do not speak English. They speak Creole, to a lesser extent Spanish and French. So it was obviously a sign that the real message that was being sent was to the anti-immigrant forces here in the United States, so that the Biden administration could say, oh, we're getting tough on those Haitians. We're doing everything we possibly can. We're pushing them, you know, to stay there and whatever it may be. But it was a very clear statement, I think, to people in Haiti then about the importance of the immigration issue. And I think absolutely when you look at, you know, key swing states like Florida, and obviously important states, at least economically, New York, other places, you know, the idea that There's going to be a huge flood of Haitians coming into the country because of the racism that's also tied to Haitian migrants. I mean, we know immigration in general is so tied to racism. But if we can remember the so-called Haitian boat people, you know, they were accused of being the initial vector for AIDS in this country. It's these people who are coming from Haiti. The Congressional Black Caucus in 1994, people may remember, you know, they were being arrested, chaining themselves to the fence of the White House to protest these issues of Haitians potentially being deported because of the terrible conditions that were happening there. So this is pretty consistent over time, but a large number of Black migrants coming to the United States is seen as a political problem. And I think that the Henry administration is using that to their advantage because they know that they have no legitimacy. But as long as they have the monopoly of force behind them of the United States, you know, they can rule. It's basically impossible to rule in Haiti without the support of the United States. And since they're giving a little political gift, and we can also see Henry was invited to Biden's so-called Summit of Democracy, total farce Summit of Democracy.
Summit of Democracy, as the guy who was taking calls from the leader who was assassinated, who just kind of pirouetted into power and is staying there with immense opposition. Now we're doing a summit on democracy. Just like think about that for one second. I know you are, but audience, think about that for one second. It's unbelievable. Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I had the opportunity to confront Secretary Blinken about that exact issue. And he, of course, just gave me a bunch of boilerplate answers or whatever. But I mean, you can say whatever you want about the people who were not invited. But at the very least, at least millions of people have showed up to support them in different kinds of ways. Some people can question whether or not it was the majority, whether or not it was whatever. But it's certainly more than 10 completely random senators and the U.S. government deciding he was going to be there. So it was such a farce on so many levels, but it's a reward for his desire to be politically useful.
So now we're here in October 2022, and you talk about the gang violence, the fact that there's been a cholera outbreak in Haiti, famine as well. Conditions are really, really difficult, and the United States is essentially backing this unelected prime minister who nobody wants, and there is unrest, naturally. So we have this now seeming agreement between the United States and Mexico that they're going to push the United Nations to send forces in. They seem to be moving forward with that, based on what I've been seeing. What are the ramifications of this kind of involvement, and where are we now with that?
Well, you know, I think the ramifications could be huge. I mean, you mentioned the cholera outbreak, and it's worth mentioning the last UN occupation of Haiti, the Minista occupation. There was an outbreak of cholera that killed 10,000 people, and it was now been proven that that cholera was introduced by those UN forces. But there's also the massacre in Cité Soleil. And what we've seen, whether it's the 1915 to 1934, whether it's the 1994 to 1996, whether it's what we saw from 2004, which I believe it was 2012, maybe that Minista was out of there, whatever that exact time period was, is that what these occupations have done is they essentially short-circuit any indigenous Haitian political process. And they supercharge the already existing reality of pushing export-led promotions and agro-industrial extractive policies. So ultimately, they strengthen the forces that basically keep the Haitian people poor. They increase the amount of violence against the Haitian people who are rising up against these policies and massacres and things like that. And as we saw with the cholera epidemic, they've opened up the possibility for the introduction of disease and other things, because since sadly, many people don't really care that much about Haiti. It only is on the front pages and these rare certain moments. There's an element of lawlessness that comes along with these. I mean, in 1915, they just stole all the gold out of the Haitian treasury and brought it to the United States. And so these sorts of interventions and occupations, they tend to increase the level of violence in the country, increase the level of poverty in the country, and just further entrench the worst possible forces in an anti-democratic way. So where we are now is an interesting space. And it's worth noting that the U.S.-Mexico resolution is not to send a UN force, but a multilateral force, and not under Article 7 of the UN Charter. And what's important about that is it means that it's essentially a totally lawless force. They would be sending in this multilateral force under, I mean, and already, you know, the UN Charter is not governing all that much, but there would be essentially no real legal authority or accountability for this force, which I think from a violence perspective, since it's allegedly being being aimed at security should be a very scary thing to people. Haiti's a country that's had a long history of death squads being used by the elite and foreign forces that have killed thousands of people, and it could be that kind of situation because there will be no accountability. But that being said, the big challenge is who's going to send troops, because the level of resistance in Haiti is so strong that you could even see from the commentary in the Security Council on last Monday that many people felt like, well, we're not saying we're against it, but what's going to happen if we go in there? And certainly some forces on the ground have said they will resist with arms. So far, the Bahamas and Guyana have said that they would send troops. Those aren't really robust military entities there, so it's not going to be just them. So there's going to be a big question. Allegedly, there's supposed to be a vote this week to approve the UN resolution. From everyone I've talked to at the UN and other places, the expectation, the resolution will pass. NPR was reporting this morning that it would take a couple more weeks, they're saying, after that, to set up this military armed force. Very unclear how it's going to play out. But I think the very likelihood right now is, say, unlike 2004 in the coup, or unlike 1991 in the coup, or unlike the period after the earthquake, where you had some sort of, you know, I wouldn't call them legitimate, but at least significant forces who were willing to sell out Haiti to these other forces and provide, you know, help provide some level of stability to what they wanted to do afterwards. You don't have that now. You have an extraordinarily fractured political scene. So it'd be more like Somalia, I think, in 1993. And we see the level of violence that was caused there and how it set back the Somali people to such a huge degree. So I think the stakes are super, super high here, but it does seem that, you know, the U.S. government, the core group countries and others have been trying to get the Henri and something called the Montana Accord, which is like a larger collection of Haitian groups that have been pushing their own solution and are opposed to this intervention, by the way, to come together. And they were not able to come together for a range of reasons. And in that kind of international vacuum over that, the forces like the Washington Post, like the president of the Dominican Republic, like a lot of forces in the OAS have now surged to the forefront to say, well, the only solution is military, because there isn't going to be a political solution. So we need a military solution to back Henri. And one final thing I'll say about this, this has been the case really since 2016. Michel Martelly, who came in as the president then, said Haiti needs a Fujimori solution, referencing Fujimori, the dictator of Peru, who sterilized 250,000 peasant women in the 1990s. And I think that's the type of situation we're setting up here now, would be Henri, zero legitimacy, big international force behind him, using that power to impose himself on society, which means a tremendous amount of violence and suffering.
It is just, I mean, an unbelievable set of facts that the United States is so desperate to maintain its control over Haiti that they are going to back up an unelected leader despised by his people, who is the source of immense unrest and economic despair, risk violence and crackdowns against Haitian people by imposing an international force on them, all, which is, by the way, something that we've done to this country for decades and decades, punishing them, punishing Haiti for daring to stand up to colonial forces. And they've been being punished for centuries at this point. And we're just going to triple, quadruple down on this. And there's going to be blood in the streets.
I think that's 100% correct. I mean, it's you know, Haiti is generating tens of billions of dollars a year. And that amount of money on the one hand, and also the fear of Haiti, because Haiti is a lot of political consciousness in Haiti. When I was, for instance, we were there on the march, I was noting to people how it was very cool to be marching along John Brown Avenue and take a left onto Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. So this is a country that, in addition to, you know, providing a huge amount of profits for the West, it also, if they were able to have a self-determining government, I think would be speaking up around the world for important progressive causes. And the fear of a good example, the fear of losing all that money, means that however many Haitians have to be sacrificed over the years, they will do anything possible, the U.S. and others, Haitian elites, to make sure that the status quo doesn't change.
Last question. If people want to call their representatives to raise their voice to stop this, what should they say?
I think if people want to call their representatives, they should say that this, the possibility of a U.S.-UN intervention has no support amongst the Haitian people. It's been opposed by the broad swaths of Haitian civil society, that multiple occupations like this have failed to address the core issues that are afflicting the Haitian people. And the U.S. government needs to not back any sort of U.S. intervention and needs to start addressing more directly the type of state-level capacity building and developmental policies that have been pushed by governments in the past to address these core issues of poverty, instability, and capability to really change the country. But we know that these things won't work, that it's going to be violent. And I think really emphasizing that past failure will be important.
Eugene Puryear, host of Breakthrough News and author of Shackled and Chained, Mass Incarceration in Capitalist America. Eugene, thanks so much for coming on. Hope to have you on again, especially if there's more developments in Haiti.
Thanks so much, Emma. I'd be honored to come back anytime.
All right. Really appreciate it. All right, guys. Well, with that, we are going to wrap up the free hour of this program, and then we're going to head into the fun half. But first, Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Well, people can go to I don't have actually the link, but live this Sunday at the Telegram Ballroom in Los Angeles is going to be me, David Griscom, Ben Burgess, Jason Miles, This Is Revolution, I see Derek Varn, Anna Kasperi, and there's a few other people I always forget because we got a long list, come out and see us. It's going to be fun. Tickets are going. There's like a site that's scalping tickets. You don't need to, like, we're not actually that in demand where you need to pay $50 or extra charge to whatever website decided to scalp tickets for us. Yeah, go check it out and come see us this Sunday. But and we had Harvey K on Tuesday night. Go subscribe to us on YouTube. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning.
On ESVN today, Bradley and I will be giving our picks. This is the first week that Bradley has overtaken me in our head-to-head competition by one game, which has me in my feels. But I looked at the lines preemptively last night. Usually I'll just check them out right before the show. And
trying to get an edge on it?
Yeah, I was trying to get an edge, put some more thought into it, because I'm getting nervous. So I think I have some good ones picked out. I feel fairly good about this. Hopefully the lines didn't move too much today.
Mm-hmm. But, sounds like a problem gambler.
Yeah. Yeah, you have me pegged. But we'll be talking about that. Our competition's heating up. But also, we're going to be diving deep into, and I'd like to, the owners' meeting that happened on Tuesday, where Dan Snyder is in the midst of a congressional investigation and an internal NFL investigation. And most of the owners have kept mum on it, even though he's been accumulating, or maybe because he's been accumulating blackmail on them.
Yeah, didn't he say, like, I could take this league down?
Yeah, and that's been documented. It's very likely he was the one who took John Gruden down by releasing those emails. So that was kind of a shot across the bow. But Jim Irsay, the renegade owner of the Indianapolis Colts, actually spoke out against him. And so that's some drama that I'd like to give you guys some updates on.
That when he said that, Dan Snyder said that thing about, like, yeah, you know, maintaining probably.
He wasn't quoted, but it was an article deep dive into it's been open.
Yeah, if that comes out about a billionaire, it's true. Yeah. It reminds me of this book that I haven't read yet, but it always looks interesting, by Dan E. Moldia from 1989, Interference, How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football.
Ooh. I mean, hey, they are like 32 mob bosses, essentially. So we'll be talking a bit about that. YouTube.com/ESVN show. This will be the last OT on the Majority Report channel. So the flagship show will be on here for a while, but subscribe to YouTube.com/ESVN show for the rest of the content going forward. Hello, friends.
Hello.
Hello. What's up, guys? And what is happening on your programs? You guys get to duke it out for who goes first to plug.
Well, I will go first and first apologize for my poor internet connection last week and being unable to join you two. That was very unprofessional of me. And you know what they say, not everything that isn't your fault isn't your responsibility. And I should have taken more responsibility to get my internet fixed before the stream. So I'm going to apologize to you and the viewers and, you know, also use this opportunity to plug my own show, The Discourse.
Yes.
SoundCloud.com/The Discourse, Patreon.com/The Discourse. That's actually wrong. It's Expanded Discourse. Crap. Nevertheless, we're all here. Matt.
Man. We're off to a rocky start here.
That was chaotic. That was only up from here.
Yep, exactly. Matt. Binder's sound is off.
Is not coming through. Sorry,
not
Matt.
Coming through. Maybe I can read your lips. Doomed, the discourse, crypto. Matt?
Those are three of my favorite things.
Talk to us.
No, we might have to fix it.
All right, we're going to have to fix it. But Yola, how about now? No? No, still nothing. All right, well, check out Doom, check out Scam Economy, guys. And then on the other side, in the fun half, once we get Matt's audio fixed, we will we'll give you a fuller rundown of what's happening over on his two shows. All right, 646-257-3920. See you guys in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.